trekken in de richting van de beide schurken Super en Hyper die hem geworpen hadden. Nu zou men verwachten dat Super alles wat hij had gedaan in omgekeerde volgorde nog eens zou verrichten. Hij zou dus eigenlijk de granaat behendig hebben moeten opvangen en in zijn koffertje opbergen. Maar nu gebeurde er iets vreemds. De misdadiger, die het gevaarlijke werptuig op zich toe zag suizen, kwam in opstand tegen de tijdwetten en sprong opzij. Het is natuurlijk hoogst eigenaardig. Maar begrijpelijk is het wel, want men kan de tijd nu wel achterwaarts laten lopen, maar het verstand doet daar niet aan mee. Zelfs wanneer men aan het verleden denkt, gaat men vooruit. En dus zou ik zo zeggen dat verleden dat herleeft altijd toekomst is. Een feit is dat Super weigerde de handgranaat te vangen en daarmee gaf hij een onverwachte loop aan deze geschiedenis.
Terug naar het verleden. Daar is het tenminste rustig. Ik had het al eerder moeten doen.
Er is geen zin. Heer Olivier meent dat die ontploffing nu niet zal plaatsgrijpen, maar dat is een vergissing, want we lopen en als wij lopen, loopt de tijd. En als de tijd loopt, is er een toekomst. Zelfs al lopen wij terug, want dan is het verleden de toekomst, hoewel ik niet begrijp wat ik bedoel.
Werkelijk dat ik daar om de hoek van de straat in de toekomst een ontploffing gehoord had.
Best mogelijk. Maar ik moet weer eens terug, burgemeester. De zon begint weer te dalen en met een half uurtje zal de morgen wel gaan krieken. Dan heb ik nog nachtdienst.
Dag, Bas.
Ik heb een raar gevoel in mijn geheugen. Ik weet niet wat het is. Toen ik straks met de burgemeester sprak, had ik daar nog geen last van, maar ja... Wat wil men? Men wordt steeds jonger en dat geeft kwalen.
Zo. Dat museum van oudheden heeft me goed gedaan.
Goedemorgen, Tom Poes. Goedemorgen, meneer.
Goedemorgen, commissaris. Dank u wel.
Dank u wel.
Van mijn huis. We schieten niet op. We komen nergens. Het verleden begint al even nevelig te worden als de toekomst was. Ik wil naar de andere kant van deze rivier. Misschien is het daar beter. Misschien is daar een weg naar Bobbelstein.
Dat kan. Kijk, daar is een brug, als u mij toestaat. Maar erg sterk lijkt die mij niet, heer Olivier. Zo'n brug over de tijd is alleen maar van boeken gemaakt en dat is zulk zwak bouwmateriaal.
Onzin.
Heer Olivier is te fors gebouwd voor een brug over de tijd. Ik ben bang dat dit niet goed afloopt. Wat te doen?
Als je mij nu even naar binnen helpt... Grootvaders klok in, kan ik heel bommel aflossen. Maar owee, het uurwerk is helemaal in de war. Het is de hoogste tijd. Wat mag er aan de hand zijn? Wat doet bommel met zijn tijd? Dit kan helemaal niet. Maar ik ben machteloos.
Maar kunt u niet in die klok kruipen en de tijd van hem overnemen?
Friemelpraat. Wachten tot 5 uur, dan moet bommel zich melden. Door dat deurtje, je weet wel. Maar nu de tijd stilstaat, zal alles plat worden. Oh, bommel verdoet zijn tijd.
Misschien kom ik aan de andere kant op een weg die naar Bommelstein voert. Dit geloop door nevels is natuurlijk een erg verantwoordelijke taak, maar het kost me te veel tijd. En ik krijg...
Heer Olivier, kijk toch uit! U kunt door de brug zakken met uw goedvinden.
De wijzers. Die draaien zo hard dat je niet kan zien of ze voor of achteruit gaan. Wat betekent dat?
Er is iets gebeurd. De tijd is in gevaar. Had ik mijn zeis nu maar hier.
Joost!
Heer Olivier verkeert in grote nood. Hij verdrinkt in de tijd. En dat is levensgevaarlijk.
Ik spring... Met uw goedvinden. Heer Olivier, hierheen. Met uw welnemen.
Het water was taai en dik en het begon er naar uit te zien dat Joost het slachtoffer ging worden van zijn edele daad. Want hij slaagde er niet in het zware lichaam van heer Bommel naar boven te krijgen. En tot zijn ontzetting bemerkte hij dat ook hij zelf niet meer op kon stijgen.
Oh!
openmaken. Ik kan niet wachten tot 5 uur. Want dan is er kans dat het nooit weer 5 uur zal worden. Er is iets ernstigs aan de hand. Help ons omhoog.
Waar komt al dat water vandaan? Oh, ja. Ik weet zeker dat de klok goed droog was toen we hem hier neerzetten.
Ja, pa. Friemel praten. Hier wordt de tijd op een gruwelijke manier vermorst. Het is een schande. Alsof het niets kost. Tijd is geld. En hier druipt het de klok uit.
Ja. Waarom doe je dan niets? Als dat water tijd was, heb ik het idee dat heer Olly op het ogenblik in gevaar verkeert.
Klim op die stoel en help me eens naar binnen. Ik ga de tijd overnemen.
Zorg dat heer Olly en Joost terugkomen.
Rotsels.
Oh, wacht. Tijd. Ik heb hem mijn maag vol.
Ik loop mijn keel uit, als ik zo vrij mag zijn. Maar het is toch goed afgelopen met uw welnemen. De heer Klokker kwam net op tijd. Anders zouden we verdronken zijn. Uw pap met uw welnemen.
Nou, zo is het gegaan. Waar Super en Hyper gebleven zijn, weet ik niet. Ze schijnen ineens te zijn verdwenen.
Gelukkig maar. Maar het is mij een raadsel waarom ze dat oude ventje wilden ontvoeren. Wat moeten twee schurken met een klokker doen?
Dat is heel eenvoudig. Als u mij toestaat, zou ik willen opmerken dat tijd geld is. En als ze die kleine grijsheid hadden, hadden ze immers de tijd. Alle tijd van Rommeldam zelfs. En dus ook alle geld, met uw welnemen.
Een diepe gedachte. Een aardig idee. Toen ik dus de tijd in handen had, had ik alle geld in handen. En ik heb het niet geweten. Maar och, voor een heer speelt geld geen rol. Als jullie begrijpen wat ik bedoel. En wanneer Joost er niet geweest was, zou ik er zelfs in verdronken zijn. Je moet iedereen die zeeën van tijd heeft wantrouwen. Leer dat van mij, jonge vriend. Zo iemand is levensgevaarlijk.
Goedemorgen, burgemeester.
Morgen, Bas.
Kan het waar zijn dat wij vanmorgen al een ontmoeting gehad hebben? Over een uur of zo?
Mogelijk. Zoiets herinner ik mij ook. Ongeveer om deze tijd, dacht ik. En er was iets met een paar schurken die door een ontploffing in het verleden verdwenen.
Ja, nu u het zegt. Een warrige geschiedenis. Ik ben bang dat we een griepje onder de leden hebben.
Mogelijk, Bas. Ik zou in staat zijn om aan mezelf te twijfelen, maar ik heb opgemerkt dat alle klokken stil zijn blijven staan. En ze wijzen allemaal 5 uur aan. Dat geeft toch te denken. Maar we zullen nooit weten wat.
Daarmee is deze ware geschiedenis eigenlijk uit. En wat de oude grootvaders klok betreft, die bleef verder droog. Maar hij liep niet meer en daarom werd hij door Joost en Tom Poes weer naar het vlieringje boven de zolder gedragen. Want het was nu wel duidelijk dat er iets vreemds met het uurwerk was.
Herinner mij eraan dat ik dat ding nooit weer aan de gang laat brengen. Mijn goede vader zei altijd, Olle jongen, blijf meester van je eigen tijd. En daar houd ik mee aan.
You grew up in Kentucky. What was
I was an army brat.
Okay, what was your first crime?
First crime was shoplifting. My mom, and I've spoken about this a few times, but I'm from Eastern Kentucky. Hazard is coal country. My dad was coming out of the military. He was a captain in the Army, helicopter pilot. Army downsizes, he gets booted out. He goes back to mining coal, is what he does, strip mining. So a bulldozer operator is what he was doing. My mom was a nurse, an LPN, and she worked long enough to see Dad off to work, and then she would go out, and we call it whoring around. She would go out and party with other men, just horrible, horrible stuff, and just abuse out the wazoo from, I remember one time, me and my sister come home, I was probably 8 or 9, my sister a year younger, and the bus drops us off. The hood of the car is up. So we walk by like, that's odd. We walk in. Denise asks Mom.
So we walk in. Mom is sitting on the sofa in the living room with her legs crossed, acting all chill. I was like, what's wrong? What's up?
Yeah.
Where's Dad? I don't know, she said. I look on the floor and I see like pieces of marble broken off. The TV is pulled out from the wall. And I was like, what is this?
So there's some spaghetti on the stove. We go to get some. And Mom's like, no, don't touch that. Don't touch that. That's for your father. Well, what had happened was my mom had cut the spark plug wires on the car so Dad couldn't get away. She cuts the cable behind the TV so that when he goes to turn the TV on, there's no signal. You know, you just got the snow on there. So he gets behind the TV trying to see what's going on. As he bends over the TV, she takes a marble statue, clocks him in the head with it. The spaghetti on the stove had rat poison in it.
So he had ended up walking, I forget how many miles, to the hospital. And he still has a piece of that marble, like, in his skull.
Right.
But, of course, with us, her story when we'd gotten home was, I don't know where he is.
I don't know.
I don't know why that's on the floor.
That was my mom. And this is not atypical. I remember that when my dad, the one time he tried to divorce her, me and my dad were living in an apartment. My mom had my sister. My mom climbs in the window of the apartment. I wake up hearing this, you know, this noise in the living room. Walk in, my mom's got a knife to my dad's throat, threatening to kill him. That was my mom. So, and she was a criminal. So,
what was she so bent on killing him for?
My mom's problem was she always, and it's weird with her. I think it's because of the way she grew up abused as well. But her issue is that she always had to test people's love. If I do this to you, will you still love me? If I sleep around on you, will you still love me? If I threaten to kill you, will you still love me? If I abuse the kids or neglect the kids, will they still love me? My dad was so crazy about my mom that he put up with it, and he became the enabler of the family. He was scared of losing her. But I get the worst parts from Mom and Dad. From my mom, I get that criminal mindset. From my dad, I get that fear of the people that I love leaving me. And that's a lot of the reason that I break crime historically. It's for cash, but I use cash to buy love.
These are true stories from the dark side of the internet. I'm Jack Reesider. This is Darknet Diaries.
Hey everyone, it's me, Simone Biles. As a world champion gymnast and a former foster kid, I've faced my fair share of complexity, and I've learned that the concept of controlling complexity is about more than just overcoming our own hardships. It's about helping others overcome theirs too. After all, in the face of enormous complexity, the best not only find a way to adapt to the challenge, they also find a way to give back. From now until the end of the year, Axonius will make a donation to Friends of the Children for every demo completed. For more details and to sign up, go to axonius.com/friends. That's axonius.com/friends.
So today we're going to hear the wild and crazy story of Brett Johnson. This is one of those stories that I was very skeptical at first. Like, no way did he do all this. But after talking with some people who knew him and reading all the police reports, it checks out. Oh, and I should mention there are a fair bit of swear words in this episode, and it has some adult and mature content. So, fair warning. Brett grew up in a weird situation. His dad was no stranger to doing illegal things. For instance, his dad was a helicopter pilot in the military, and one time his dad tried to sell some stolen hand grenades. And after the military, his dad tried running drugs back and forth to Mexico as a helicopter pilot. And at one point, he even tried becoming a cop with the sole idea that he was going to do a drug bust and somehow keep the money he confiscated. When all those plans fizzled out and the family had no money, that's when Brett's mom decided to take the kids and run.
At that point in time, we were in Panama City, Florida. My mom leaves my dad. Me and Denise thought we were coming up to Kentucky for a funeral, and we weren't. Well, I mean, there was a funeral, but we thought we were only going to be gone a week. So we packed enough clothes for a week. My dad thought we were only going to be gone for a week, and I don't see my dad again for, 10 years, something like that.
His mom took the kids and moved to Panama City, Florida, and they moved in with her parents. Her dad was just as crazy, super strict, and pretty abusive. Just to give you an idea, they weren't allowed to eat any of Grandpa's food, and they weren't allowed to make any noise after dark. And he was very strict on how much water they could use. For instance, he wouldn't even let them fill up the bathtub. And both Brett and his sister Denise did not want to be around Grandpa when he gets angry.
We had no soap.
Right.
We had really very little clothes. I mean, 2 pairs of panties. And you weren't allowed to wash them.
Or you'd have to wash them by hand.
There was that, you know. I remember going over to Pizza Hut and stealing the soap from Pizza Hut so I could bring it back and wash my underwear in the sink with the soap. You know, but I had to be careful because if he knew I was doing that, I was wasting water and that would set him off. And if you set him off, his goal was to kill you.
And it was. I mean, we had that round table in the kitchen upstairs in their house. And there were times when he would get the butcher knife on you and you'd do the little dance around the table until he got tired. And then he would finally sit down and he would look at you and say, "Don't let me catch you, I'll kill you."
Or he'd get really upset and then he'd go looking for his gun. And that's time for you to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'd leave for a while and come back in a few hours.
Your parents are sorrier than whale shit and we should not have to feed you.
And they didn't want to feed us.
No.
So, mom had been gone for a few days. She started partying, using drugs, everything else like she was doing. We didn't have any food in the house. And, you know, I was the guy that was scared that mom wasn't going to come home because she'd tell us that we'd find her dead someplace, that she was going to commit suicide, that she'd given up her life for us, everything else. So she'd been gone. I'm worried she's not coming back. Denise never worried at all. Denise was just always mad at her. We were living downstairs from my grandfather. He had converted the downstairs into apartments, and we weren't allowed to go upstairs to eat. They just wouldn't let us. And this one time, I was 10. My sister Denise was 9. So Denise walks in one day, and she's got a pack of pork chops in her hand. And I was like, "Where'd you get that?" And she was like, "I stole it." And I'm like, "Show me how you did that, sister." So she takes me over to A&P, and she shows me how she's stuffing, you know, meat and everything down her pants, and I'm like, "Well, we can eat." So we start stealing food, and we look across the way because we were wanting to make sandwiches. That's the actual story, is we were wanting to make sandwiches. Well, you can't stuff a loaf of bread down your pants. Well, Kmart was across the way, so we went over there and stole a hoodie so we could stuff bread down the sleeves of the hoodie. That's when we found out, hey, we can shoplift clothes, and then books, games, jewelry, toys, all that stuff. Mom finally comes home and sees, you know, the new Intellivision that I'm playing and everything else. And where'd that come from? And I looked at her and said, "Oh, we found it." And she's like, "No, you didn't find that." Denise stands up, never lies at all. Denise stands up, "We stole it." My mom looks at my sister she's like, "Show me how you did it." Not only does she join us, but she goes and gets her mom to join us as well. So it's grandmother, mom, me and my sister taking these road trips to different malls to steal clothes. And, well, they stole clothes and jewelry. I'd always go to the bookstore first and steal books because I like to read a lot. And we were at the Fort Henry Thomas Mall in Bristol, Tennessee. They had dropped me off at the B. Dalton bookstore. They had went in JCPenney's, and we were supposed to meet back at the vehicle, I think like at 1:30. Well, I came back with a load of books. Nobody's there. So I'm standing around about 30 minutes like, okay, where are they? And I'm only like 10. So I'm like, where are they? So I wait a while. Finally, I'm like, okay, I got to go in and find them. So I stuff the books under the blazer, walk into JCPenney's. As I'm walking in, there's two security guards standing right in the entryway there. And I hear my name, Brett Johnson, come over one of the walkie-talkies. And I'm like, hey, that's me. And they're like, that's you. And I was like, yeah. And they're like, come with us. So I go, they take me to the security room, and my mom and grandmother, they're huddled in a corner, crying, screaming, telling everybody they didn't do it, didn't mean to. This is the first time we've ever done it. Denise is in the opposite corner. I mean, she's just, I mean, Denise is ballistic, just angry, staring holes through like she could kill them right there. That's the first crime that I committed there.
That marked the end of his sister's criminal behavior. She totally stopped shoplifting after that. But this was the beginning of Brett's criminal career. He continued to shoplift and steal, never getting caught for it either. Then he watched as his mom did criminal acts too. His mom was shoplifting, and he learned she was drug trafficking, and she would sometimes call random people to try to get them to donate to a charity, but they were really just giving her money instead. And this is called charity fraud. She even tried to steal heavy equipment sometimes. She was kind of an opportunistic criminal, getting involved with whatever came her way, and Brett was watching it all. And after some years of this, Brett started talking with his dad again, but only over the phone. His dad had his own issues. He was breaking the law and stuff too. And when Brett was 15, he got his first taste of jail.
When I was 15, I was in Eastern Kentucky. My dad had called. I'd called him, and he said he was getting married. And I was always of the opinion that I was going to, you know, that dad was going to save us. So, he said he was getting married. I went to the I was at the hospital on a payphone there. Got in an elevator and ended up assaulting a woman that got on the elevator with me. I guess I snapped or whatever. I don't know. I was 15 at that point. I was charged with assault in the first degree, so they put me in solitary for 6 months.
Why do you think the news from your father getting married caused this?
I think that was the last, and I don't think it caused it. I think that it was, looking back now, I think that I had taken mentally as much as I could, because it turns out the woman looked a lot like mom. So I think that I had just, with that final news of dad, I think that I'd always been the guy that thought I was going to, you know, it took me to save me. And I've lived my entire life like that. If you're going to do something, do it yourself. But, when I heard that from him, I think that child in me, that small part of having hope of somebody saving me was finally gone. And maybe I realized that that just wasn't going to happen. So I don't like to make excuses for that, because it was a horrible, horrible thing. And I've lived my life, I mean, every single day I've thought about that, and I wanted to mention that because I think it's important. I think it's important to the story and everything.
This is going to be a heavy episode. Brett pleads guilty to this assault and goes to juvenile detention for a few months and starts attending high school in Hazard, Kentucky. This is where he finds a teacher who saw potential in Brett. He excelled in academics and drama in high school, and because he was doing well, he actually stayed away from crime for the most part. He graduated high school and wanted to be an actor, and he had some scholarship offers, but ended up just going to the community college there. He gets a part in a play. Then the head of the theater department from the San Jose State University in California came to see his play and saw Brett's performance.
As soon as he sees it, he comes up to me and he's like, I'll give you a full ride scholarship if you want to come to San Jose State right now. And I looked at him, I was like, done, let's do this. So I agree to the scholarship. He tells me it's going to be great. He actually says, hey, you're a big fish in a small pond. I'll make sure you're a big fish in a big pond. You'll go someplace. So I was like, let's do this. So he's like, I'll be back in a week. So he leaves, he flies back down in a week. He drives to my house. We were living in Airport Gardens at that point. I'm shooting basketball with some friends. He pulls up. I come over to meet him. I was like, hey, let me walk in and I'll introduce you to my mom. And he's like, no. He said, I can go in and meet her. I was like, all right. So he goes in, and he's in there, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, something like that. He comes out, never says a word, gets in the car, leaves. And I didn't know what had happened. Find out, I don't know, a couple weeks later, I find out that my mom He goes in to meet her and talk to her and tell her, you know, the opportunity that I've got and everything else like that. She pulls a knife on him and says, you know, I will, she had this line she used to say. She said, I will cut you from gizzard to sternum. And you're not going to steal my son from me. That scares the man to death. And of course, the scholarship and all that goes out the window at that point. That, I don't know, I guess part of that kind of broke me of leaving.
There were similar problems going on with his sister. She was older by this point and going to college too, but her mom had a tight grip on her and didn't want her to go away and was doing very manipulative things to keep her. But the people at the college, about 90 minutes away, saw a glimpse of what Denise was going through and gave her a full scholarship and a place to stay and even protected her. This gave Denise the chance she needed to escape the bad gravity of her mom and get an education and get on her feet. She became a teacher, and a pretty good one, winning Teacher of the Year even, and she stayed clear of any criminal behavior.
So I continued in community college. Had a girlfriend that was a preacher's daughter, and those were very, very decent people. For the most part, I didn't think about breaking the law or anything else. That relationship fell apart after 5 years, and I met my first wife. Her name was Susan. Susan wanted out of home, out of Hazard, Kentucky, and I knew that I kind of used that as a...
Plein soleil, plein soleil, et la ville est toute engourdie de sommeil au soleil de midi. Je t'attends au soleil, près de la fontaine attiédie. Je t'attends au soleil, mon ami. Dépêche-toi, elle est jolie ta robe. Je tends les bras vers cette fleur qui vole. J'ai mon vélo, je t'emmène à la plage. C'est pas loin, mais le joli voyage. Plein soleil, et le sable est chaud comme un lit, un grand lit. Au soleil, et youpi. Youpi.
Ich war drauf und dran, in das Exil zu gehen.
Dank u.
Par moi-même, personne n'a jamais pris dans ses bras. Ça vous étonne, mais c'est comme ça. Elle avait de l'amour, pauvre
Melody Nelson.
Mais elle en avait. Et ses jours étaient comptés, 14 automnes et 15 étés. Un petit animal, que ça.
Melody Nelson.
Une adorable garçonne. Et si délicieux enfant. Que je n'ai connu qu'un instant. Oh, ma mélodie. Ma
mélodie Nelson.
Aimable petite conne. Tu étais à condition sine qua non. De ma raison.
Thank you.
a celebration to last throughout the years. So bring your good times and your laughter too. We gon' celebrate your party with you. Come on now. Let's all celebrate and have a good time.
Celebration.
We gon' celebrate and have a good time. It's time to come together. It's up to you. What's your pleasure?
Hello and welcome to the History Hour with Max Pearson, where this week, following the dramatic news of a sudden thaw in relations between the US and Cuba, we'll be hearing detailed and personal reflections on that fraught relationship. There are lots of key moments that followed the overthrow of the US-backed Batista regime in 1959, and in the next hour we'll be in the Bay of Pigs, on the inside of the missile crisis, with a Pope in Havana, and in the murky world of US-Cuban espionage. A History Hour Cuba special then, during which I'll be joined by Julia Zweig, Director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. We'll begin, though, at the moment when the US-Cuba relationship fell apart after Fidel Castro's communist revolution. This report from one of the BBC's Latin America specialists, Mike Lanchin, is focused on January 1961.
Castro marks the second anniversary of his revolution with the biggest military parade ever staged in Cuba, featuring tanks and other heavy weapons from Russia and Red Czechoslovakia. Shortly afterwards, Castro demanded the United States Embassy drastically reduce its staff to 11 persons. It was the last straw in his long campaign of provocation and harassment. President Eisenhower broke off diplomatic relations with a message read by Press Secretary Hagerty.
There is a limit to what the United States in self-respect can endure. That limit has now been reached.
We had already been told to cut down to 2 suitcases apiece, and so we were ready to go. When relations were broken, it was a matter of pack your bags, get ready to go, and we did.
Within hours of the announcement, Wayne Smith, a young political officer at the American Embassy in Havana, was joining the rest of the mission's small staff, getting ready to be evacuated from the island.
Most of the families had been evacuated a couple of months before, so they were gone. They were just embassy employees. My wife, I think, was one of the few women.
And what was the scene at the embassy like when you left?
I guess the thing I remember most is the crowd around the embassy wanting us to give them visas before we left, sort of chanting and waving their passports and don't go until you give us a visa.
That must have been quite a difficult situation to deal with.
Sure, it was a very painful event. You know, I had a great fondness for Cuba and wondered if, not if, but when I would be able to come back. Oh!
It had all been so very different in 1958 when the 26-year-old Smith had first arrived on the island.
It was run by Batista, of course. The casinos were all run by the mafia. Nightclubs booming. So it was a very interesting but wild place.
And a playground for America's elite. But the US was about to lose its key ally. President Batista's hold on power was collapsing as left-wing guerrillas led by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara closed in. Wayne Smith still remembers New Year's Eve, 1958.
Word went out, Batista was leaving the country. We had all been, of course, to New Year's parties. Must have been about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. The doorbell rang. I opened it. It was an embassy officer, and he said, sort of a slurred voice, I think he'd have something to drink, said, Wayne, the ambassador wants everyone down in the embassy. Don't ask questions. So I went, and that was it. The ambassador wanted us all down there to begin organizing our reaction to the Batista exit.
What was the atmosphere in the meeting like?
Well, yeah, I would say there was an atmosphere of concern, but because it was what was coming was unknown.
Officials in Washington now had to decide how to react to Cuba's new government. Castro hadn't yet declared himself a communist, but Wayne and his colleagues were already having to deal with a growing number of supporters of the old regime asking for help.
Very soon we had long lines in front of the embassy, people wanting to get out. Now, if there was nothing in their records that would ban them from going to the States, we normally would give them visas. But there were so many of them.
But it wasn't all hard work for Wayne and his colleagues in those first few months of the Cuban Revolution. There was still plenty of time to relax.
In some ways, life didn't change a lot. The nightclubs remained open. The mafia no longer running the casinos, of course. The Hotel Nacional had a nightclub, and we often went there. It was, I think, one of the best, and they also had a good restaurant. There were plenty of restaurants and so forth where we had gone before, and they did not close. And our movements were not hindered, although we had the impression often that we were being watched, but we could still move about. There was the matter of the anti-Castro forces planted bombs and so forth. I remember one night, for example, my wife and I were in a movie, and a flare went off right in front of us, and we thought it was probably a bomb going to explode. So we and most of the people in the movie rushed out. Anyway, those things did happen, and it changed life.
The Cuban authorities blamed the U.S. government for these attacks, and the atmosphere in Havana soon began to shift.
I remember being in a car, and it was an embassy car, and there were some other embassy officers in with me, and we ran into a group of revolutionaries in other cars, and they started shouting at us, go home, Yankees, and that kind of thing.
How did you react to being shouted at like that, do you remember?
We ignored them. That was the best thing to do, just ignore them. Certainly not to shout back. It would have been stupid.
By mid-1960, though, Washington was shouting back.
Fidel Castro whips up a furor in Cuba, charging the United States with arming and training mercenary forces for an imminent invasion. He calls out some 200,000 militiamen for training and guard duty at key points throughout Havana in a move timed to coincide with the landing of 1,400 American Marines at the Guantanamo Naval Base for a weekend of liberty after training exercises in the Caribbean.
Was there a notable change in the atmosphere inside the embassy?
Well, I would say there was to some extent. I remember, for example, one afternoon, two of our secretaries having a quarrel. One was pro-revolution, the other was anti-Castro, and they had a very bitter quarrel over it, and the one who was pro-Castro eventually left the embassy. So there was that. There were differences even in our embassy staff, although most of them, of course, remained loyal to us because they wanted to keep their salaries. And maybe they agreed with us. Who knows?
Few on either side of the divide were surprised when in early January 1961, President Eisenhower broke off relations and closed down the American embassy. As his boat edged out across the Havana harbour that day, Wayne Smith, who's now in his 80s, remembers taking one final look back towards the shore and spotting in the distance the lights still on in the embassy building.
The lights were blinking on and off, as though to tell us farewell. Years later, when I returned to Cuba for the first time, I went to the embassy. I met with embassy employees, many of whom had been there when we left. And I asked one of them, I said, "Were you the guy who turned the lights on and off?" And he said, "Oh, you did see it then." I said, "Oh, yeah, we saw it. We much appreciated it." It was a farewell sign.
The former U.S. diplomat Wayne Smith was talking to Mike Lanchon and giving a very vivid impression of those heady days in Havana. Julia Zweig at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington is with us for the hour. Remind us, Julia, first of all, what had happened in those first couple of years after the Castro-led revolution that turned relations between Cuba and the U.S. quite so bad?
In those couple of years that Wayne was narrating, the new Cuban government under Fidel Castro had begun to nationalize Cuban property, to nationalize American property quite extensively, and to begin in other ways with his rhetoric, with his tango with the Soviets, to signal that life of the party, which had been Washington, had been the U.S. ambassador, had been the Americans in Cuba, was about to shift and fade out, as Wayne clearly narrated. First Soviet delegation to Cuba arrived in February of 1960 when Khrushchev sent Anastas Mikoyan there to meet with Fidel. And of course, this is the middle of the Cold War. Cuba is 90 miles away. It's a place that the Americans presume to be theirs. So that invitation, his arrival there, was quite a provocative move in addition to the other nationalizations of American property and the rhetorical escalation.
So why didn't relations rupture immediately, though? Because it can't have been a surprise to Washington the direction that Castro was going to take Cuba and for nationalization. I mean, many in the U.S. saw that simply as theft.
Well, you're correct to ask why not immediately, and especially because even in 1958, before Fidel took power, the Americans were looking for ways to delay that, to prevent him from taking power. Not all Americans. The CIA, in fact, its station chief in Santiago de Cuba, was helping Cuban rebels sneak on and off the island via Guantanamo, helping them acquire weapons. The CIA was unimaginably today, perhaps, sympathetic to those that were challenging Fulgencio Batista. So there was not a uniform view within the Eisenhower administration of exactly how to handle this major change. And there was also some interest in the State Department, for example, in trying to make it work, in trying to figure out exactly how far the Cuban Revolution was going to go, because its progressive elements, that is, those people associated with overthrowing Batista, not just Fidel, but the professionals in the urban underground, for example, and those who were in Washington lobbying against Batista, trying to get the American support for seeing the importance of change there, they had some credibility. So it wasn't at all clear that the full radicalization that we saw by 61 and later into the 1960s was going to be a done deal as early as 1959, 1960.
So a touch of schizophrenia in Washington, which may well emerge again later in the story. Julia, for the moment, thanks. Well, after the full rupture in diplomatic relations, the formal rupture, things quickly took a turn for the worse. And just months later, in April 1961, a group of Cuban exiles, organised, armed and financed by the American CIA, made a first and doomed attempt to invade Cuba. They sailed from Nicaragua by boat to a place on the Cuban coast called the Bay of Pigs. As part of his research into these matters, Mike Lanchon has also been speaking to one of the invaders, Alfredo Duran.
We didn't really know where we're going to be landing and what the plan was until we were on board the boats in Nicaragua. But once we were on board, we were told of the plan, and everyone was like very much looking forward to it. We believed that we had a cause that was good, and that we were doing something that was for the benefit of the Cuban people and the future of Cuba.
Ever since Castro's overthrow of the Batista regime just 2 years earlier, many young Cuban exiles, like Alfredo Duran, had been keen to join any attempt to unseat the revolutionary government, but they lacked the organisation and the funds. In the US government and the CIA, they found both.
In Miami, there were agents, CIA agents all over the place, and there were people in every corner who were saying, I just went and recruited, and I'll be leaving the next couple of days. And it was very open. There was a recruitment office, and there were places where you went also to have your health checked.
There was also a plentiful supply of arms and training in how to use them. From their secret CIA training camp in Guatemala, Duran and his fellow conspirators travelled to Nicaragua, boarding boats bound for Playa Girón, or the Bay of Pigs, an isolated area some 200 kilometres south of Havana.
We landed at night, and it was probably one of the first nighttime amphibious landing in the history of warfare. We were supposed to be landing on beaches without rocks, and ultimately it was a very rocky beach. And a lot of the landing craft, which were basically pleasure boats, they were not really landing craft, hit the rocks, and many of them sank, and we were thrown into the water with our ammunition and everything else.
But that was just the start of things going wrong.
And in the morning, the Cuban Air Force discovered our landing ships and basically came in and bombed, sank two of them, and the other ones had to retreat. So there we were in the beach, just with the ammunition and supplies that we had on hand.
Worse still, the underground movement that was supposed to assist the invaders never showed up, nor had they blown up the access bridges as planned to slow down Castro's troops. Duran and his fellow fighters were soon outnumbered and outgunned.
After the third day, we ran out of ammunition and we ran out of supplies at all, and we were basically abandoned on the beach, and we had no other choice than to fall back to the sea and hope to be rescued until we find out, of course, that we would not be rescued.
When you realized there was going to be no rescue effort, what did you do next?
We all of a sudden realized that we had to separate from our battle companies, and me and three other fellows decided that we should go into the swamp, try to cross then to change clothes and get some clothes from some farmers or steal them someplace and dress and try to get to Havana and try to somehow escape back to the United States or take asylum at an embassy. I personally was captured when trying to cross a sugar mill where I was trying to cross to be able to steal some clothing and change clothes. And while I was crossing the sugar mill, I was brought upon by militiamen with dogs, and I was captured. We were so fatigued and so tired that we expected to be shot. So when I was captured, I told the people that captured me, just give me some water and shoot me.
But the militias didn't shoot him. He and more than 1,000 other fighters were kept alive. They were, after all, a perfect propaganda opportunity.
We were put in buses and trucks the next day and driven through Havana. Through that whole process from the sugar mill town to the city of Havana, all along the highway, there were people shouting and yelling at us. And we finally ended up in what is called the Sport Palace in Havana. And there we were sat in the seats in the stadium, and they started processing us.
You must have felt, to a certain extent, humiliated in this defeat.
Well, more than humiliation, because we all felt that we were there doing our job and that we did the best we could under the circumstances. It was a great big disappointment to having been abandoned. At that point, we felt that we had been misled. We did what we were supposed to do. We fought with courage, and while we could, we continued fighting.
Duran spent the next 18 months in jail in Cuba, before being released along with other exiles in an exchange for cash and medicine from the US government. He returned to Miami, where his ill-fated journey had begun.
In Miami, it was like a festive day. The whole city was celebrating the arrival of the members of the Bay of Pigs, and we all felt like a hero. And not only did we all feel like a hero, we also had a very strong desire to try it again. That was the conversation of all of us. We basically were, from the day of arrival, we're trying to see how we could try to organize again or to continue on the struggle.
Alfredo Duran did eventually get back to Cuba, but not as a conquering hero. In 2001, he took part in a convention marking the 40th anniversary of the invasion. He was allowed in by the Castro government, along with US officials.